Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Don't look now, but there are only 364 shopping days left till Christmas, gang. So, what's your pleasure? Online or in the flesh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today is the 26th of December. It's a Friday, and it's good to have you with us. This holiday season hasn't been so good, though, for most retailers. Not only aren't they selling as much as they'd like, a lot of what they do sell, they've got to discount so heavily they're losing money. That is, most retailers, just not all of them. Although it didn't give actual dollar amounts, Amazon announced this morning it's just had its best holiday ever. The company says on December 15th alone, it sold more than 6 million items. That's almost 75 sales a second. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains why Amazon was able to buck the trend of one of the worst retail shopping seasons ever.
Sarah Hubner has a bit of an online shopping addiction.
I have a weakness. Well, I don't call it a weakness. Books. I love books.
If she hears about a new author on the radio or a subject piques her interest, it's only a matter of time before
I get bored at work and I switch over to Amazon.com. And
so far, her little addiction hasn't pushed her into the poorhouse. Her online shopping cart is full of deferred purchases. Her wish list is long. A decade ago, Hubner would go to the mall to do her holiday shopping. But these days, she tries to avoid the big chains, the parking lots, and the Muzak. And by shopping online, she may even save some money, too.
It has very competitive prices, and for time-starved consumers, there was nothing better.
Michael Silverstein's a retail analyst who follows Amazon for the Boston Consulting Group.
It is the easiest, fastest shopping. You can actually buy things for everyone on your list in 20 minutes.
Amazon may have benefited a bit from some big snowstorms this holiday season, but that's not the only reason Amazon seems immune from this downturn. Silverstein says Amazon appeals to a different demographic than some of its competitors.
It's actually a little richer, younger, educated, more computer savvy. The segment that continues to go to the mall typically has more children, slightly lower middle-class incomes, and
it's been hit a lot harder in this recession. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
If you spend some of today doing old-fashioned brick-and-mortar shopping, you probably saw some pretty incredible deals. Retailers across the country are cutting prices to drive sales and make up for their run of bad luck this holiday season. They've got to get inventory out of their stores to make room for the new stuff. But those lower prices you might have been seeing aren't across the board. Certain items are selling at the low, low price of full price. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
There are a few things at play when it comes to which items are being discounted, says Kathleen Siders, a marketing professor at Boston College.
One has to do with the chain itself, the store, the company, how its sales have been.
And for most, sales have been disastrous.
The other has to do with the type of merchandise, whether it's more utilitarian, because if it's more utilitarian, then those companies don't have to be in such a rush to get those products off the shelf.
For instance, stores selling kitchen goods can hold their inventory and sell it later. That's why the copper stockpot at Williams-Sonoma still costs almost a grand. Clothing stores, meanwhile, have to make room for the spring lineup. And Sider says that means some painful discounts.
If you're looking at a 70% discount, chances are the company's losing money on that product.
A sign of things to come, perhaps. Siders expects a wave of layoffs and bankruptcy filings in the retail sector after the new year. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Traders were paying just about full price on Wall Street today. The last Friday of 2008 ended to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As I said, Wall Street's not going to have Friday afternoons to kick around anymore this year. We got out of the markets today without any of the last hour hysterics that have been so common this fall. And yet there is more we don't know about what's going to happen in the new year than we do know. So a little something different this Friday for a weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, politics mixed in with the economic. Michael Mandel writes for Business Week. Dan Dresner teaches political science at Tufts University. Hello to you both.
Hello, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Michael, let me start with you and ask you this sort of very macro classical year-end question. Has what happened this year in the economy changed the way we behave?
Yes, it has. At this point, it's really discouraging people. It's making them much more pessimistic about the future than they've been in the past. It may turn out that they're overly pessimistic, but we don't know that yet. So that's what's happened right now.
The reaction, though, Dan, is going to be a political one when the new administration takes over. What's going to happen in this stimulus package that we're going to get? I'd like your sense on how big it's going to be and how well it's going to work.
I think the better question to ask is what's not going to be in the stimulus package? This is going to be a pretty large package. I mean, you've heard rumors ranging from $500 billion to $1 trillion, although there are fights already brewing over what the nature of the stimulus is going to be. Are they going to focus on green investments versus more traditional manufacturing? But my guess is the Obama approach is probably going to be why not spend on everything? Given the need for pumping up the economy, I think you're going to see a much bigger stimulus package than people have been talking about today.
Michael, $1 trillion?
I'm betting on $1 trillion. I think it's going to include aid for state and local governments, extended unemployment benefits, both to sort of get the stuff moving in the short run. And then they're going to have a bunch of stuff that's going to be more long run hitting a year, even 2 years out.
Michael's right. And one of the problems is that a lot of the stimulus packages that have been talked about, things like building infrastructure, most studies have shown that it takes about 18 months for that stuff to sort of kick into the national economy.
All right. But wait a minute, because I've been told, and a lot of economists have been saying, 2009-ish, June, July, August, things are going to start turning around and we're going to be fine. Why do we need stimulus that lasts beyond the end of this recession?
Which economists are you talking to, and when did you talk to them?
These are people in California, aren't they, Kai?
Yeah, that's right. It's the L.A. economist.
Here's the problem. Right at this point, everybody's ratcheting down their forecast. And what we've moved into is the doom and gloom phase of the economic forecasting, where people are actually projecting a downward sloping line. And really, they're also projecting not just a lack of recovery, but that even into 2010, that the recovery is going to be very slow. So I think what's happened is that there's a lot of consensus that this is one occasion where you throw a lot of money in and you don't worry so much when it's going to hit.
All right, here's where you guys earn your money. What are we not thinking of that needs to be fixed for things to get going again? Dan, you first.
I think one of the things you're going to have to fix is the fear of rising protectionism. One of the natural instincts in a downturn is for countries to try to protect their own. The U.S. bailout of the auto sector, for example, is certainly one example of this. But to what the United States looks like a natural reaction to a failing manufacturing sector, to a lot of the rest of the world looks like illegal subsidies. The United States protested, for example, when Airbus received subsidies because it was in financial trouble a couple of years ago. The European Union is going to point to what the U.S. has just done and say, how is that any different?
Michael, what about you?
Actually, I agree with Dan 100%. I did a story about a month ago on how much of a fiscal stimulus was going to leak overseas. And so imagine what happens when they start rolling out these infrastructure spending. And we ask the question, is the steel, is the concrete going to be bought in the U.S. or overseas? I think that a fight over protectionism is going to turn out to be one of the big issues in 2009.
Dan Dresner at Tufts University up in Boston. Michael Mandel, we talked to him in New York. He's with Business Week. Thank you both.
Thank you, Kai.
Glad to be here, Kai.
The list of banks taking federal bailout money is a long one, more than 200 of them in all. Right up at the top are the biggies, Citigroup with $45 billion, Wells Fargo and Bank of America at $25 billion. Scroll all the way down, though. Keep on going. There's a bunch of them. At the very bottom, you'll find Saigon National Bank down in Orange County, right here in Southern California. It got a relatively paltry $1.2 million. But why? We asked Rob Schmitz from KQED to find out.
The name of the cafe is the Coffee Factory, but here in the immigrant enclave of Little Saigon, they call it CNN. This is where dozens of Vietnamese men gather each morning, and over cigarettes, coffee, and newspapers, they loudly discuss the news. Lately, they've been discussing the bank next door to the cafe, Saigon National. It's a community bank whose clients are mostly local small businesses, like a machine shop and a radiology clinic. You might think that receiving government bailout money would be a stigma. Not here. Van Nguyen is a major investor in this bank. He's gotten pats on the back and shouts of congratulations by many who are proud that a hometown bank got a cut.
They read in Vietnamese newspaper here. They sometimes call me and ask me, hey, how do they get that kind of money? We are very proud of that.
Since when is needing bailout money a source of pride? Well, need really isn't the correct word. When I walk next door to ask Jack Kennedy, the CEO of Saigon National, whether he actually needed the federal money, here's what he told me.
On a strictly yes or no, no. But you're always planning ahead as a business manager.
Wait a second. Isn't the $700 billion in bailout money meant for banks that need to be, well, bailed out? Actually, no. Saigon National is a prime example. A key measure of the bank's financial strength, its equity capital, is four times as high as the minimum required by regulators. Kennedy says the $700 billion isn't so much a bailout of faltering banks, but a vehicle to increase lending and stimulate the economy using banks with healthy balance sheets.
I don't think Congress intended that the money be infused into institutions who were weak. You know, a bank that's weak in a down economy will continue to be weak, if not weaker.
And for Saigon National, taking the bailout money was good business, plain and simple. In order to grow capital, banks typically sell preferred shares that pay out interest at 7 or 8%. In order to get a slice of the $700 billion, Saigon National had to sell preferred shares to the government. But the government only charges 5% interest. Kennedy says the lower rate should allow him to make more loans.
The capital infusion or addition will allow us to leverage that capital. What that really means is that for $1.5 million, we could potentially loan out another $15 million.
And that would increase Saigon National's loan portfolio by 34%. Not bad in these economic times. Kennedy says he's been swamped with calls from other community banks asking for advice on getting their own share of bailout money.
It probably encouraged other small banks. They said, well, if that bank can do it, then we can do it. We're not going to be discriminated against because we're small.
And it's the thousands of small banks around the U.S., Kennedy says, which will help pull the country out of the doldrums by putting more money in the hands of small businesses. In Little Saigon, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up, the economy takes center stage in the UK.
Everybody we knew was obsessed with what they were doing at work, how much they were earning, the house they were living in, the car they were driving. And we thought, we've got to somehow encapsulate all of this in a musical.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained more than 0.5% today, 47 points to close at 8,515. The Nasdaq rose 0.3%, 5 points, finished at 1530. The S&P 500 climbed more than 0.5%. That's up 4 points, 872, the number at the bell there. For this shorter holiday week, the Dow was down about 0.75%. The Nasdaq fell 2.2%. The S&P 500 lost 1.75%. In case you missed the news, retailers were on sale today, and so were their stocks. Shares of Macy's slumped 2.5%. Nordstrom fell 1.25%. Dillard's dropped nearly 5%. JCPenney, on the other hand, cashed in with a gain of more than 1%. We talked earlier about Amazon bucking the dismal retailing trend. The online retailer said it had a comparatively successful holiday season, but its stock rose just 0.75% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. do the work for you. Download Marketplaces After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Parliamentary elections are scheduled in Bangladesh. The election brings to an end 2 years of military-backed government. On December 29, 1845, Texas was admitted to the Union. The Lone Star State was the 28th to join. And Oscar-winning actor John Voight celebrates his birthday. He'll be 70. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A lot of the talk about this financial crisis being the worst since the Great Depression has usually included a reference to an economist named John Maynard Keynes. Keynes was a classic macro guy. He believed in government intervention, manipulation of interest rates, and lots of deficit spending in a slowing economy. Franklin Roosevelt helped prove him right, but commentator Todd Buchholz says Keynes' teacher might be the one who steers the way out of this economic debacle.
Arthur Cecil Pigou has been dead 50 years. And this is his last chance. During the Great Depression, this Cambridge professor was slapped about by his pupil, John Maynard Keynes. To Keynes, Pigou was a fuddy-duddy who wouldn't change his models even though Britain was ripped apart in the economic equivalent of Gallipoli. Today's meltdown was ignited by Wall Street banks, drunk on leverage and equipped with all the foresight of a palm reader in a circus tent. Headlines blare, falling oil and food prices. Economists warn of a greater depression. But Pigou argued falling prices make us wealthier. If, when we go shopping, we feel as if we've got more buying power, consumers can lead us out of the dumps. Balderdash, thought Keynes. Better for the government to whip out its checkbook and hire workers to dig tunnels, even if they went nowhere. Pigou's idea flopped during the Great Depression, because the Fed let the amount of money in circulation shrink 30%. No cash, no jobs. Now Pigou and Ben Bernanke have a second chance. If the Fed can buy bonds and force more money into circulation, the Pigou factor can revive the economy. We are witnessing a furious battle. On one side, the frightened shopper. She has more buying power. Turkeys were 89 cents a pound at Costco, but she is fighting the fear of new job losses. Will the 90% who avoid layoffs deploy their new spending power? President-elect Obama, Tim Geithner, and Larry Summers can help. Cutting payroll taxes, keeping capital taxes down, could boost confidence and spark hiring. That's better than bailouts and Keynesian make-work bridges to nowhere. Early in my career, I taught with Summers at Harvard. He and Bernanke are masters of Pigou and Keynes. Now they must use the wisdom of the last 100 years not to settle a decrepit academic dispute, but to save our standard of living. It's not just Pigou's last chance.
Todd Buchholz was an economic advisor to the first President Bush. His most recent book is called New Ideas from Dead CEOs. We'd like to hear from you, the living. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. Todd Buchholz was talking about tapping into the wisdom of the past 100 years a minute ago. I'd say just this past 1 year has been plenty, thanks all the same. We're going to spend some time this week and next looking back at the year that was, and it does seem to make sense to start where all the troubles began, that is, on Wall Street. We've got our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott on the line to do just that. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so listen, we've been doing this story for what, a year and a half now, right?
That's about right, yes.
All right, but I need you to give me the 30-second reminder of how we got to where we are in the case of Wall Street.
Well, just speaking of securities firms, we can talk about Bear Stearns back in March running into some serious trouble because of its investments in the subprime mortgage market. J.P. Morgan Chase ended up coming to the rescue by buying Bear Stearns. It was a huge deal, the demise of one of the big five independent investment banks. But then September rolled around. Lehman Brothers found itself in a similar position. This time there was no rescue. The firm filed for bankruptcy. And that was a real turning point. Merrill Lynch arranged to be bought by Bank of America. And then, of course, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley laid the groundwork to become more heavily regulated commercial banks in exchange for some federal help. And then, of course, to cap it all off, one of Wall Street's own, former NASDAQ chairman Bernard Madoff, confessed to pulling off perhaps the biggest Ponzi scheme ever. So it's been quite a year on Wall Street.
Let me pick up on a word you used a minute ago, demise. There was a lot of talk as all this was happening that Wall Street, you know, as we knew it, was dead. What's your take on this?
Well, I would say, based on the people I've talked to, it's not dead, but certainly humbled quite a bit. Most of the people I've been talking with over the past few months believe that Wall Street will survive. One person said, it's going through a tunnel, it'll be dark in there for a while, but it will come back out eventually. And it'll look quite different. The big firms will be more regulated, probably more cautious, at least for a while. But people say that the innovation and the risk-taking that really defined Wall Street will still go on, but at smaller firms and at hedge funds, at least the ones that survive.
So has there been any real change then in the culture? I mean, are these folks still trying to be, you know, the masters of the universe?
Well, you know, it kind of feels like the party is over, at least for a while. Of course, thousands of people have lost their jobs. There's been a lot of criticism that the banks are still paying some sizable bonuses to those who are left, but they're much smaller. And you're just not seeing the same kind of money being thrown around. One example, the legendary Manhattan strip club Scores is closing down. It was said to be frequented by Wall Street types. Some nightclubs have reportedly stopped doing their expensive bottle service. You know, that's partly because of the general economy in the city, but I think it's also kind of a sign of the times.
We should confess that we've tracked you down on vacation. You're not actually in New York right now, but obviously you live there. You spend a lot of time covering Wall Street. How does it feel? Does it feel any different to you?
It does. You know, I would say it's generally pretty freaked out. You know, the real estate market, the economy in New York are very tied to Wall Street. I recently read that nearly one in every $4 employers paid in salaries last year went to people in finance jobs. So people are naturally worried about what all this means for New York. But, you know, I was living in San Francisco after the dot-com bubble popped, and I recall a sense sort of sanity returning to the city. New York, similarly, had become such an inflated place, and many New Yorkers were feeling sort of pushed to the fringes by the excesses and the wealth. So I think some people are hoping the city might become a place not just for the wealthy again.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, our New York bureau chief. As I said, we tracked her down on vacation. She's actually in Mexico today. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Of all the ways that you have heard or read or thought about the fallout from the financial crisis, I'd be willing to bet this next story is going to bring something new to your experience. The Brits have a year-end tradition of musical shows. They're called pantomimes, pantos for short. There are heroes and heroines and, of course, evil villains. This year, though, there is a more contemporary scoundrel, the financial miscreant, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
One, two, three, four, five tickets for this afternoon's Jack and the Beanstalk.
At the Courtyard Theatre in Hereford, parents and kids eagerly snap up tickets for the Christmas panto. Writer and performer Lindsay Marple says they won't be disappointed. The show has all the traditional elements.
The booing of the baddie, the cheering, the hissing, and just generally joining in. It's a big fun party between the actors and the audience.
But this year's Jack and the Beanstalk is a little different. The villain isn't the giant, it's an evil financier.
I am incredibly evil, even though I say so myself.
Baron Wasteland is his name. A speculator by trade, he's drowning in debt on his property portfolio, so Wasteland doubles the rent on Jack's cottage.
And just because this is a fairy tale, don't think that you lot with your pathetic booing and hissing can do anything to stop me, because you can't. Oh, no, you can't.
Oh, yes, you can.
In pantos across Britain this Christmas, traditional villains like wicked stepsisters and evil witches have been replaced by a new breed of miscreant, bankers bent on ruining the global economy, hedge fund managers that bring businesses to their knees. Lindsay Marple says the financial crisis was the theme that panto could not ignore.
Well, it was something that everyone's talking about, and pantomime very much reflects the current situation that people are in. There's also a sense of we're all in this together.
The crisis has also inspired Crunch the Musical. Due to open in London early next year, the show is currently in rehearsal.
When the corporate races run, you're logging off and your deals are done. You'll meet your maker with a funded pension, yeah.
Dom Hartley is a former financial journalist. He actually began writing the show before the crunch. He and his lyricist set out to satirise the boom.
Everybody we knew was obsessed with what they were doing at work, how much they were earning, the house they were living in, the car they were driving. And we thought, we've got to somehow encapsulate all of this in a musical.
Once the crunch began, Dom and his partner found fresh inspiration.
By leveraging infrastructure, modernizing knowledge culture, this benchmark will become the paradigm.
This number is entitled Corporate Fraud. It lampoons the jargon at the heart of the crisis, the language bankers use to disguise the rubbish they were packaging up and selling around the world.
Debt, loan, income, vehicle, mortgage, debenture, fund. Debt.
In the current climate, a cast of singing and dancing financial miscreants may be too much for some. Or it may be the best, the only way to get some fun out of the credit crunch. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
When you know the debts to brim, you can sell most anything. When you know the debts to brim, you can sell most anything.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, an ode to the humble eyelash. They can be batted flirtatiously. They can get caught in the eye annoyingly. And as of today, they can be enhanced chemically. The pharmaceutical company Allergan says the FDA has approved its eyelash-thickening drug, Latisse, it's called. It'd be brushed on just like mascara, and it's meant to treat what can actually be a pretty serious condition, not having enough lashes to keep dirt and debris out of the eye. But Allergan's CEO said in an interview this summer the market for the drug would be all women aged 18 to 60. That would be a much bigger group than uses Allergan's other big-name product, and that would be Botox. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Christmas week Friday. Today, the Dow gained more than 0.5%, 46 points to close at 8,515. The NASDAQ rose 0.33%, 5 points, finished at 1530. The S&P 500 climbed more than 0.5%, nearly 5 points, 873. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, what the recession of 2008 means for 2009.
It means we don't have enough money to buy. Or if we do have a cash flow, a lot of us are far more reluctant to buy anything that's extraneous.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.